Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone. And now, your host, Paul Mercurio.
All right, hey everybody, welcome to the podcast. Before we get to my very special guests, a couple of old friends of mine, I'm here in Los Angeles. I'm going to be on the road. Come check me out March 2nd to the 4th. I'm at the Punchline in Philly. I probably should have these in front of me. March 22nd to the 25th, I'm in Edmonton, Canada at the House of Comedy. March 29th, April 1st, I'm at San Francisco Punchline, and then I go to Detroit after that, blah, blah, blah. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com, see where I'm going to be, come on out, hang out, and go review the podcast on iTunes. It's always nice to have some nice comments. If you don't like it, don't say anything. Your mother say?
Keep your mouth shut.
Keep your mouth. If you got nothing nice to say, keep your mouth shut. So those are the voices of the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason Sklar. I'm here in Los Angeles, and I won't say exactly where because you might have stalkers. I'm at the house of one of the guys, and long-time, old-time friends going back to New York. Welcome. Glad you're on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, man. Thank you. You did a great job on our podcast.
And yeah.
I encourage your listeners to listen to you on our podcast because you were fantastic.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
Yeah, your comedian origin story is one of the most memorable, best, and weirdly connected to our own. You know, I don't know if you know this, but I don't know if we told you this, but we both went to law school. We were going to be lawyers.
We didn't go to law school.
We got into law school.
But you went to University of Michigan. Yeah.
And then we both got accepted to law school.
But didn't go. But I'll say this, it's so funny you describing that story, and I'm sure your fans know it. But from our perspective, okay, the story, because we lived in New York, and that's where we met.
Yeah.
That's where we hung out.
Yeah, we used to do Rebar and those
Rebar, but like
also the clubs.
Yeah. All the clubs. Like we would see you on the Friday, Saturday night circuit we'd pass the night and be like, all right, where are you going next?
Yeah.
Like, I'm going over to
and you're rushing to get a cab.
We're going down to Gotham. All right, we'll see you.
Shit, it's raining out. I'm never going to get
a cab. I'll see you up at Stand Up New York at 10:50.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? So like we used to run around and do that with you.
Do like eight sets a night. Night
and get so good.
Yeah.
Get so good and sit around as comics. We do eight sets a night and then we would sit in your, have like $300 in your pocket to go out with your friends later. Be like, I'll meet you at midnight. I'm done with all my sets at midnight. It's Friday night, New York, you go out. But what was cool about it was that each of those sets was like a separate evening for that crowd. You were just like dropping into other people's evenings.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like little elves and then just popping But my out. Point was that we lived in New York and we had jobs and we temped and worked in offices in New York. And that late night, just the thought of you writing jokes in an office, send off, in your office, late night New York, the people, you know what I mean?
It was crazy.
It's like we know that feeling of being in that office. I just think about those moments.
And I remember I want to make this about you, Nami, but just for a second, I remember like waiting. I just would watch the clock for like 7 or 8-ish when most of the lawyers would go home and then I could focus on writing comedy.
That's
and I wouldn't have to hide it. And it was like classic, like someone would walk into my
office.
You're
coming out of the closet as a comedian.
Yeah, exactly. And then I found out later, I went to a reunion of my law firm like recently, and this guy comes up to me, goes, you remember me? And it was like I'm like, Bernie. He goes, you know, remember I ran the information center, because what you did, you know, you had these thick ass documents, so you sort of mark them up and you hand them in and someone works on them, and then you either wait, you go to dinner, or you work on something else. You weren't actually typing the changes in. Well, all those documents had passwords, and I had my joke document in there with a password. He goes, you entertained me many a night. I go, what do you mean? He goes, I was reading your jokes at night. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
Audience.
And he goes, I had everybody's password. I ran the thing. He goes, I go in the back door. He goes, you had some good stuff there. I was very impressed.
That is.
So yeah, it was, it's so funny. I'm going to see Leno while I'm here. He's the one that I sold my first joke to. I'm going to see him while I'm here.
Awesome.
And he's been a great guy, but, but now I'm curious, so why not law school? And I'm interested, it's interesting that you both decided to apply. By the way, identical twins. My father's identical twin, by the way.
Yeah, I think you told us.
Yeah.
What was your relationship with your uncle? Like, did you feel close to him?
Which one?
Your dad's brother.
It was the most fascinating thing. I'm sorry, his twin. Yeah.
His twin,
So in the 50s. My parents were born, we grew up in Rhode Island, and again, I don't want to talk about too much about myself, but anyway, settled in Rhode Island, Italian family. My Uncle Benny, my father's name is Arthur, identical twin. And this is like, we have these old time Italian pictures. I don't know if you did this. Did they dress you with the same clothes ever?
No, they didn't.
You probably get that asked all the time. I'm sorry.
They were conscious to not.
Well, my father, they did. And they look so fucking identical that they had to put a handkerchief on the pocket of my Uncle Benny so that the family could figure who was what where later. Long story short, my Uncle Benny moves to Los Angeles. My father was a blue-collar guy. My parents have a small furniture store. My father put floors in for a living before that. He was like a work clothes Budweiser kind of guy. Mm-hmm. My Uncle Benny moves here. He comes up with the idea. He gets a contract with all the major appliance makers to repair and repaint any damaged appliances that are damaged in transit on trains. And
genius.
And on
genius
trucks and
idea.
Makes a ton of money from that.
Yeah.
Buys a bar, buys another bar, buys a restaurant, and becomes like L.A., like the big side, the sideburns, diamond horseshoe pinky rings, smoke lucky strikes, and he would only drive
suits,
and he would only drive powder blue Eldorado Cadillacs,
Jesus.
White convertible.
Became a player, player.
So every 2 years he would drive. He was deathly afraid of flying. So every 2 years he would fly. He would drive his Cadillac. He knew somebody that worked at GM high up. He'd drive his Cadillac to Detroit. He'd get a new Cadillac. He'd drive to Rhode Island,
visit the family.
Clung to him.
You love this.
Well,
guy.
It was like the classic, like the evil version of your dad.
Yeah.
Like it was literally like, sorry, there was a movie and they're like, okay, so Arthur, you're going to go and change. You're going to come out this other person. But he looked the same way. His eye, all
was
of his movement.
Cool? He was a good guy.
He was cool. And I remember now, like, you know, like I'm a parent out. Like, just imagine you go on vacation and you already have three kids. And then this fourth kid is like, I was sleeping in their hotel room. Yeah. I remember sitting in the pool one day. I was 12. And I'm in the pool, and I got my hands, like, you know, my arms up on the deck of the pool, and my uncle's sitting there, and he's talking, and I just remember looking at him and going, wow, this is fucking crazy, because it felt like this Elvis version of my father.
It's crazy.
Unreal.
It's interesting. Unreal. I mean, we can't, because we do the same thing, and we're in business together, that moment that you're describing can't happen for us.
Right.
You know, like, I think our kids are super close with, each other, like my kids are close with him and vice versa because
how old are the kids respectively?
So my Randy, my kids are 9 and 11. Right. So you know we did that to commemorate what happened. I think that's just a fitting for this year at least. And no, they're 9 and 11.
Should have named one of them VJ for victory over
Japan. That's right, and we're gonna turn them into just one kid later. But there's been a lot of problems with the Port Authority with doing that. But
which kid is the memorial?
That's right. We don't want to make them too tall either. So they're wonderful, two daughters, and they're complicated, awesome people, and you know what it's like. I have almost a 12-year-old, so my 11-year-old is going to be 12 in June. She's in sixth grade, and she's in middle school, and the 9-year-old's in fifth grade. So my kid's a little older. Jay's got an 8-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter.
Oh, okay.
So the 8-year-old, it's funny because the 8-year-old and the 9-year-old act like brother and sister. Like they fight in the way that brother and sister fight. Really? My 11-year-old is great with everybody.
Yeah.
My 9-year-old she's very really like adamant about getting her way and being apologized to. And it's interesting.
They're all brought up the same way, but they all have their
so
own
different.
Personalities.
So different. Yeah. I love it. It's just like managing to you feel like you're a baseball manager and you're managing like two different personalities. Yeah. Like one is like shows up at work. She just, you know, takes grounders, does all the work in and out. And then the other one is like a big bombastic personality from like Puerto Rico. And you're like, just please don't drive a car really fast and get killed in the off season in the Dominican Republic. Yeah.
Do they have any like guardrails? What's going on in the Dominican Republic that every time you drive there?
I want Lyft to happen there or Uber.
Like who? Like the Major League Baseball.
Someone else should just
create.
By the way,
Uber and then save all of
our.
You
live here in the United States where roads are great and you can actually go pretty fast and whatnot. But just we've been to those places in
you have
Latin America, not even Latin America, but the Caribbean in that area. It's like. It's not well defined, and if it ever rains, don't drive a sports car as fast as you can in a certain thing because it's not even you; it's someone else driving who actually knows what they're doing.
Exactly.
This is like someone inexperienced going to Mount Everest. Like you,
don't It's not just you. You're going to kill the guy who knows what the hell he's doing. That's the thing. And so it just, that's
yeah, you're going to take down a Sherpa.
You're taking down your guy.
A Sherpa who knows what he's doing. He lives on
just
that guy.
You got to bring a goddamn fax machine up, right, up to the top. I still do work while you're in the fucking
Sandy
death
pit.
That's right, in the death zone.
Oh, my
but,
God.
But no, but it's.
So you were talking about the kids. I'm sorry. We get off the.
No, our kids, you know, it is, and it is fascinating. I mean,
we do have an insane bond with each other's kids. Like, yeah. I love when his first daughter was born, it felt like a child of mine was being born.
Yeah.
It was really incredible. And I feel like I have such a close relationship with her.
They love him. They love him. I mean, they are just such fans of his.
How are you as twins? And I wasn't old enough to ever ask my uncle or my dad this, but I'm curious. I would think your personalities develop differently than if you were siblings a year or two or three apart, and you didn't look exactly alike, and you obviously now work together. So you went to the same college together. So I would imagine your personalities develop in a slightly different way than most siblings. How would you describe that? And how I've known both of you a long time, and I feel like you're pretty similar, but how
we are
you? Am I right about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, we are
and
really
how different are you?
I think we're really similar, but when you get into underneath, like the nuances, the, you know, that we are different,
yeah,
and distinctly different,
yeah,
but I think on the surface, really seemingly similar.
Yeah.
But it was great. We went through everything at the same time. That's the thing.
Which is
it's
great.
Like when if you're his kids, 8 and 3, there may be a generational gap. And I know that sounds crazy, but 5 years is the difference.
Oh, yeah.
Of, I actually think my 11-year-old daughter is experiencing life in a different way than his 8-year-old son does, because things happen and,
so fast,
you know,
yeah,
like a kid is suddenly, everything he wants to do is on the iPad. And my daughter is not really infected by that as much.
Yeah.
And so like you have two totally different kids. So because we were at the same time and experiencing everything at the same time, I feel like that shaped our perspective. Then we looked alike, and people were just like, back in the day, pre-fertility drugs, drawn to twins. It was an interesting thing, and we had people's attention.
Yeah.
And then we were like, well, what do we do with this? Well, our dad was a pretty funny guy, and we would always watch him, like, you know, our dad, like your dad, he was a really hard worker, and then in high school he owned, that's my dog, by the way, shaking himself out, English Bulldog Roman.
What's the dog's name?
Roman.
Roman.
We
like to
him.
Give credits to everybody on the show.
I'll just turn around and fart at any moment. it's like he doesn't have a bottom half of his mouth. Like every piece of food that goes in just comes right back out.
Yeah, there's three of those dogs in our building. They're so cute.
Freaking love this dog. Anyway, so no, we were talking about our dad is just a very hard worker, and then he bought the family business, which was selling alteration supplies like needle thread. If you ever go to get a suit at Nordstrom, it's never the right size for guys like us.
Right.
We're not 6'2" and you know, 190 pounds. It's like you got to get it. You got to get it altered.
Right.
And so he provided all that stuff, and there were very few of those, you know, companies.
He provided the materials to
all of
that
it, shoulder pads, lining, thread, needles, bobbins, buttons, all that stuff. And he was like the middleman.
And that was his parents' business before?
It was his uncle's business. And his uncle sold it to him. And so,
this is in St. Louis.
Yeah. So a couple things, you know, he was a very smart guy, but didn't give a shit about school or academics.
Man.
He would work. He was working 40 hours a week and going to school at night. It went to Wash U at night. And probably just squeaked by on everything, but he had a tremendous business sense and people really loved him. Like we would go with him to run errands and he'd just leave us in the car with the car running. He did real estate and would leave us in the car.
Showing a house
just with the car running. Basically saying like, steal these two kids. Like you just.
Predators anywhere?
Anywhere, just come right through.
But he had an old Monte Carlo and the door was so.
A Monte Carlo.
Monte Carlo. And the
door was so.
A two-door with a family. The least practical thing in the world.
Two-door, and it was such a heavy door.
I don't think anyone could steal us.
That door was his security system.
It's like, predators are too weak. We'll leave it running, and that's it.
Did he leave you with like cigarettes and whiskey too?
Close. He just left us. We'd listen to like the Jack Buck Call
right.
Cardinals
that
game.
That was that era. Like,
we listen to the Cardinals on the radio, or listen to the blues, or listen to whatever. Saying that's where we got a tremendous love of listening to sports on the radio. Is we'd just be sitting around and do it. But we would go and watch him. He'd go to like the cleaners, and we'd be sitting
sitting in the back seat, and we just watched through the window, and he'd go in, and within like 2 seconds of wherever he was, the person across from him would be laughing and smiling. And I think you see that over and over again. And
what was his sense of humor? Like, it's funny, Bobcat talks about his dad too.
He was like, never like, I'm going to craft a joke and do this. He just was, I'll show you a picture.
Charming?
Yes. Charming. He was this cherubic kind of, he kind of looked like Buddy Hackett. Sort of a guy who made fun of himself, and you know what I mean? I'll run up. I have a picture of him upstairs. Yeah. And he's just, he was just this guy that you just start smiling when you were around him. And so he had that effect on people. And I think as kids, you unconsciously see that and you're like, well, that's valuable. And so around our house, we would try and be funny
like your dad.
Around him. And
what
try
kind
and
of him. Sense of humor do you have that your dad had? What part of his type of sense of humor?
I just think the desire to want to connect with people. Yeah. And that
which
was
you guys
it.
Are great at.
But it's a
and you're very affable off stage and on stage. Like you're having, people have an instant connection with you, which is why. You know, you guys have been doing. By the way, love
Thank
the Burger
you.
King commercial.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm like, holy fuck!
I know those are crazy.
That was a crazy story too. Like with that commercial.
Just so people know when this is running, it's probably still running or just ran.
It's still going to run.
Burger King commercial with the two of you just talking about
riffing.
The
just riffing. We improvised for 2 hours. 2 hours, and we improvised with the director. I mean, basically.
You want my glasses? No, I don't want your.
Yeah,
glasses.
No, I do not. I mean, the crazy thing was with that commercial, and I don't know if you feel this way, but. We aren't great at commercial auditions, and to send us out on a bunch
Why do you say you're not?
Because it's a very specific skill. Mm.
There are those people and friends of ours who are just phenomenal.
To be able to turn on that ability to sell in 30 seconds.
First of all, you got to look like an everyman at times, and I don't feel like we carry that off as well.
Mm-hmm.
You
have very lovely blue eyes. Though.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. It is a very... Christ. Wow. It's just got really intimate. It's a very specific...
Why did you put your hand on
it? I don't know.
Maybe you said that.
It's a very specific...
Guys, put your pants on.
All right, wow. Sorry. I'll zip up. It's a very specific set of skills that I don't think we have. So we called our commercial agent, listen, it's not going to be a good use of our time to run all around town and audition for things. We just... it's not great. You're going to send us out and we're not going to get stuff. However, if something comes up that... you feel like they might know us, they might be interested in it, we'll do that. But don't send us out on audition. Right. So immediately after that, we get an audition, show them the picture
the
of our dad. That's our dad. See, like, what a great, like, face
know,
he's got.
The, oh, shit,
Does he look
I,
like?
God damn, I wish I had a picture of my father. He looks just like my father.
Really?
So this...
My dad had these, like, little... sort of
look
thin,
at his
squinty eyes.
Okay, so he's smiling,
chubby cheeks.
His eyebrows are raised like out, he's like I'm a little. You know, this is what's great about our dad. Okay, so and I'll get and then I'll get back to the Burger King commercial because it's cool. So our dad was like this big guy who he's no longer alive, which is really sad. But he's big guy, but he was an athlete. Like he could play tennis, he could dance. He was like a really,
really?
Good dancer. Yeah. He was like,
what was his sport? Was it football?
No, he never played football. He played baseball, and he could bowl really well.
Oh,
really
well. My father was a bowler.
And he like bowler. Him and his dad and his brother like won like a St. Louis like family bowling tournament. They like had like a total of like 620 for like
Whoa.
A series, like where they each bowled a game. He got like a 180. His dad got a 240 or something.
My dad, you know, he bowled on a team. He went every Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And then he would take me and I would bowl with him. And I
the best.
Came, you know, he had his own ball, his own shoes.
Yep. Our dad played tennis. He was not that good at golf, but like his athleticism and his health started failing. He had diabetes. He had to be in these special shoes. You had to like worry about it. Is he walking too much that he's rubbing against his thing to get a sore that would then never heal, that he'll have to have a toe amputated. There was a lot of like taking care of him like towards the end, which is a bummer because he was like, I remember our parents never really traveled because he worked all the time and he just wasn't a big travel
money.
We didn't have the money to do it. But one time when we were 10.
Do you have siblings beyond
no,
the two of you?
No, it's just us.
Right, okay.
One time when we were 10, they went on a cruise. They went like on a Caribbean, like to the Bahamas and whatnot. And I remember they came back and my mom said that they had won the dancing contest. And I was like, yeah, he just was great. He was graceful in those ways.
And what was your dad? Was your mom a little less outgoing than your dad, or what was she?
She was less. She was nice. She is nice, and she's actually
still living.
Very smart, like super smart, like national merit semifinalist. Very concerned about work and what not work, but like academics and doing well and reading and taught kids how to read. And she actually worked as a computer teacher in like a computer curriculum creator in St. Louis in the 80s. So she and her team of like these super smart minded people,
they were like a think tank
of
how to use computers in education.
Wow.
So they had like a form of email in like 1984.
Before
email was like, I'm sure other people are
parallel
developing it, but like their idea was that the seventh graders,
sixth graders would email seventh graders,
would write down questions that then and leave it on a thing that then seventh graders would answer those questions
about
and
what middle school
and go back. And so it was like basically email, you're sending out a thing and coming back. Genius. And then she went into business with our dad because he needed help because he bought the family business. That was the other thing. So he, when we were in high school, and now think about this, you have a 12-year-old, okay? Think about going $1 million into debt when your 12-year-old is 15. And he said, because our dad was just a hard-ass worker, I'll give myself a salary, but so I can
mortgage the house.
In 10 years, I'll pay this business off. I will pay off on $1 million debt, which is insane.
So he took the business on. It already had $1 million in debt.
No, he took the business on. He bought the business from our uncle who charged
him $1 million for the business.
Our uncle didn't just hand it to him. He charged it to him, which was a little crazy when you think about it. Yeah. I get it. He wanted
$1 million, though, in the 80s. Now you're talking, it's really a few $1 million.
And we weren't sitting around with millions of dollars. Right. I mean, our house was maybe at the time worth like $120,000, $150,000. Not a huge house. Yeah. It was a really nice house in terms of it was in a really sweet neighborhood, but we weren't rolling in the dough. I mean, we never were. And so for him to say,
did he have any trepidation about taking on that kind of?
He was like,
he was a balls to the wall.
He was like, I bet on myself to succeed. If he was an athlete, he would say, give me the ball. This is the end of the game. I want it to me. If he's a basketball player, he'd be like, that shot is my shot.
Are you guys like that?
Well, I think we became that, and we subconsciously or whatever, you know, essentially we're saying the same thing by choosing to go into comedy.
Yeah.
We're saying, give us
the ball. It's a high risk, you know.
You're betting on yourself.
You're bright guys. You went to Michigan. You could write your own ticket. Yeah.
Yeah, we could have gone to law.
Gone to law school. Really could have gone, but I think, you know, and it was at the time in the early 90s and when we were deciding what we were going to do when pre-internet, when if you were an English major, which we both were.
Although I do remember when we were seniors at Michigan, someone called us, like, I got a call at our house. And they're like, we're recruiters for this new thing. It's called the Information Superhighway. And we were like, what the fuck are you?
It's the future where there are flying cars.
Like, shut up.
Shut up.
What are you? This is never going to be anything.
Like, do you want to work
and
on
it? And it was Bill Gates.
No, I mean, it could
and we want to give you stock.
Stephen Hawking. Sounded like a computer.
Hello. But it was one of those things where they were recruiting, you know, people from universities, young people to work on. I don't know if it was learning coding or whatever it was, but to be part of the early stages of the internet.
And we just could have done it. We were like, we have no idea what this is. We're like, let's go into something way more stable. Comedy. No. So, I mean, but we did have to tell our parents, like, we both got into law school. I mean, I got into George Washington. Jay got into Emory and Wash U. I was waitlisted at American. I mean, we were like ready to go. Literally like. Good law schools.
And to that generation, your parents are probably roughly same age as mine. Doctor, lawyer, my son. You know, like every parent, let's make my kid's life better than my life.
And underneath it all is, I want them to be
taken care of.
Yeah. I want them to be safe. I want them to be taken care of.
Listen, I say this. I've been saying this in my act lately. I go, the most exhausting thing about having a kid, and it's a pain in the ass, is I worry constantly. I'm more of a warrior than my wife. And I've been saying once a month, for 2 days on a weekend, I want to have him knocked out with propofol just for the weekend. I know where he is.
That's right.
Have him being monitored by a doctor. Sure. And then I can go out.
It worked for Michael Jackson. Well, there were no complications there.
Exactly. Maybe I'll get his doctor.
Yeah.
Dr. Conrad.
The good doctor.
But no, I know what you mean. Like you want them to be taken care of.
And so I think that's what they wanted for us. So when we had to tell them, like, so what happened for us was that we were really huge fans started to watch a ton of comedy.
And yeah, I know. I was reading a little bit. You guys back in Michigan college, right? Yeah. You were a fraternity together.
So in a fraternity together, and what was great, and what we were. It's amazing because when you look back on it, it's like a Kaiser Soze moment where you start to put all the pieces together of your own life and be like, well, this led to this. And then this is, see how much fun we had here. And then that just complete, that was the thing we loved more than anything. Like we, you know, it wasn't like we were the fraternity types. As soon as we got into the fraternity, we kind of were like, oh, we're not that, but you know, we are.
When I read that, I'm like, they're the last guys that they don't seem, although, you know, you're big sports guys or whatever.
But I will say this about our fraternity, and I think it's why we were connected to this. It was sort of a non-fraternity in that there were tons of creative people who've gone on.
Brad Meltzer, who's like a New York Times, you know, best-selling author, he was there. Judd Winnick, who was on season 3 of The Real World, who then has like gone on to become a world-renowned, he's a world-renowned cartoonist. He's
illustrator, animator. There's
well, you're at Michigan. I mean, that's Ivy League status. But, so you're going to have a lot of creative, bright guys.
But these were different women. Types of people.
Yeah, like, there were other fraternities that were like, we're going to, you know, Kegger, and we had that too. And I mean, there were elements of that in our, and we always kind of stayed away from it. But Rush, like, this is the thing. So like when we rushed the fraternity, that was our chance to. To step into a circle of like 20 or 30 people standing there watching us just regale them with stories about like Jay and I worked at gas stations, you know, full service gas stations in St. Louis to make money for college the summer before. And we had crazy fucking stories. And like, here we are just literally holding court the way you would at a comedy show. Yeah. And we had done comedy in high school. So like
let me back up for a minute. So when I was little, I would beg my parents to stay up to watch any comedian that was on. And I don't know, something happened. And I, you know, this whole struggle of I was on Wall Street and I leave and I went back. I was really lost and confused for a few years. And I thought I was picking it, but it picked me. And I, and really looking back, it picked me when I was 10, 11, 12 years old and I didn't know it. So I'm curious about you guys. Were you in that same, like, you gravitated to it as kids?
So here are a couple things I can tell. Like,
I mean, I know you gravitated to it as your dad because he was funny, but professionally.
No, but our parents loved comedies. Yeah. And so, like, I remember seeing Young Frankenstein when we were kids. And I remember seeing Blazing Saddles on TV, and we taped it. We recorded on videotape. Yeah. And our parents said, our uncle worked in the appliance business out. Our uncle, his brother, Uncle Bob, was at Fillin' Jim's, which was this huge appliance chain in Southern California. And he sent us a Hitachi VCR. This, like, it could have been beta, but it was actually a VCR. It was one of the first versions of VCR. It had a remote.
This is the future.
Right. It had a cord that attached
to the remote.
Didn't reach the couch.
So you had to stand up and fucking.
That's why we called it a Hitachi, because the remote was attached.
So. Hitachi. So, I mean, it was like great, great technology that just screwed you in the end. So I remember one time, this is the only time our parents did this. They got the videotape of the movie Airplane. And we, at like, I think 10 or 11 or 12.
Don't call me Shirley.
That's it. Our parents invited friends over and like families over. And 20 of us sat in our living room and watched Airplane together, and we were fucking laughing so hard. And I remember that was a moment where, like, oh my god, this is an event. Okay, they care about this.
People gather around the TV,
and they care about comedy. It was like communal laughter and all that stuff. Our parents placed a premium on, like, we never did it with serious movies.
Yeah,
we did it for comedy. So then. Then Rodney Dangerfield did the Young Comedian special on HBO, and the one that we started watching the comedy, and the one that we saw that we loved was with Seinfeld and Bob Nelson and Rita Rudner and Robert Townsend. Robert Townsend, for the first 2 minutes of his act, was speaking with a British accent. And then he stops and he's like, I was born on the south side of Chicago. And we were like, he's doing something so crazy. And then Seinfeld for us was it at that point, because his jokes were so good,
precise,
so memorable. And we didn't realize, like, you know, he'd been on The Tonight Show. He had sort of taken all of his rough edges and hewed them off. Yeah. And by the time he got to that special, encourage your fans to go back and find that set on TV. That set was one of the best television sets we've ever scene of comedy. I mean,
I remember seeing it, but I don't remember it. I gotta go back.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's
now this show wasn't Dice wasn't in this.
Dice was in the second this is the second one. Sam Kinison Sam. Was in the first one.
Okay.
Sam Kinison was amazing, but Dice was in that second one. Dom Irrera was in that second one.
But Jerry was in that first one.
First one.
So and, you see that.
And we said this, and what we started to do was we watched it, taped it, watched it so many times, memorized it. And then when our parents would have friends over, like this playing bridge, they'd have like bridge people over, and like, you know, they David Feldman would
this
look
is
at
fucking crazy. You know. We were living parallel lives.
So he would come over to us and be like, "What's going on?" We would like hang out downstairs because we love the adults because we can make them laugh. Yeah. And we always, they were fascinating, and we just were gregarious, and we just liked talking to them. And they'd be like, "What's going on with you guys? How's school?" And suddenly we'd be like, "What's the deal with the shower radio? Music on a glass, next to a glass, a slick surface next to a glass door." I mean, those were like Seinfeld's bits. And we'd be like, "What's the deal?" And we're talking like Seinfeld. And they didn't know it because at the time.
We became such big fans of Seinfeld. I remember we saw him. I would love to tell him this. I mean, we've met him throughout, but not long enough to like have a conversation with him. We were such big fans when we went to see him at a place in St. Louis called the Westport Playhouse, which was a theater in the round.
Is it near where the Westport Funny Bone is, right?
Yeah. Same building.
Yes. Yep.
1,100 seats, 1,200 seats.
Yep.
We saw him there, and he was so good, and he was so funny. And I remember we were walking out of that show, and we were like, man, it's such a shame that, yes, he sold out this show, but like, the general public doesn't know who Jerry Seinfeld is. And we're like,
and they never will. Like,
we're like, same guys that hung up the phone on the information superhighway.
See, we have great instincts.
Basically,
about the
anybody out there wants to invest or make it big, find out the opposite of what the Sklar brothers are doing.
I mean, we were like,
was that around the time?
Yeah, it was like, that was probably like 2 years away from 3 years away. It was probably 86, 87.
But he was very precise, right?
Yeah, he was amazing, and he was a technician, and he was at the top of his game. What we didn't understand was we didn't understand the business. Yeah. And we had done stand-up at that point, so we were like fans of stand-up comedy.
High school.
We had done it, we were like...
And what was it about that? Like, I remember we were living at parallel lives. I would do the exact same thing.
Memorize stuff and do it for your parents' friends.
Right down to the same comic. I remember watching Rodney, then going in the next day... Standing around like you talked about at your frat, and the kid like there was the general locker room, not like the gym locker room, but you know where you put your stuff in your books, right? And that's where a lot of we congregated.
Totally.
And so like you're between class and you're standing up and you're hanging against the locker, and I just start doing Rodney more like not impress his impression, but the joke, and they're laughing their asses off, and I remember just getting a kick out of it, and I was pretty funny. I was voted class clown, whatever. I never think I was going to be a comic, but. There was something pulling me to that, like you guys. And it's
same,
so
and we loved it.
Thing,
but we had the attention of people already. They were like, oh, twins, what's up with you guys? Mm. And so we were like, so once we started to really fall in love with comedy, and we were huge fans of SNL back in the day. And our parents would go out on dates and whatnot. And then like we would be there with a babysitter. And then at the time when they would start leaving us alone, we would watch SNL. We would watch it, and then the best sketch was the Eddie Murphy years. The best sketches that Eddie Murphy did, all of it, we would go to Sunday school the next day and just verbatim, after only seeing it once, just with our friends who were funny, do the sketches that we just saw the night before and talk about them. And so it was like in our blood, and we really loved it. I mean, the crazy thing about Seinfeld is, you know, we were just, again, such fans of his. We're like, he's so good. People don't know who he was. He wasn't Robin Williams. He wasn't Richard Pryor. Yeah, it's such a shame. He wasn't Eddie Murphy.
He wasn't Billy Crystal.
He wasn't Billy Crystal, but it was like at a time when those types of comedians weren't household names, and we thought it's not possible because he's so specific. He's so like he's not general enough,
right? You know, call the comic strip in New York City where we've worked. Mm-hmm. Call on an off hour, like at 8 o'clock in the morning, and get the voice message. They have the coolest outgoing voice message of any comedy club or any business. It's all of the major acts who did their first shot on the Tonight Show.
It's amazing.
Clips. So they got Jerry going. Your car breaks down on the side of the road. You look. You don't know what you're doing. You look for an on-off switch that's off, right?
Yeah.
And then Shandling's. I'm at my friend's house, and the kid, he loads up the diaper, and
Daddy made a present.
And then Rita Rudner, and then Rosie. Like he can't get this over cushion himself.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like. they took every major act from that generation and they took a clip. It's really cool. Anyway.
Amazing. Yeah. So for us, I mean, we did stand up. So when we were like, we want to do stand up, there was like a school talent show. I mean, there
this is high school.
High school. There was
you're
this.
Not thinking you're going to do this for a living.
No way. Right. Because no one in our family was involved in it. Nobody.
Jesus Christ. It's like I'm the third brother.
I know. Exactly, or we're the second and third you.
Well, it's really cool that we all found our way into this business as a result.
But it's exactly with me. Like, my mom's like, I don't know how this happened. You were kind of quiet as a kid. I mean, I don't know. And people say to me, well, I went to law school and then planned to work on Wall Street as a way to get into comedy.
Yeah, that was my path.
Yeah.
So the most roundabout. So we're in high school and we were like loving.
Are you on open mic nights and
stuff? No, so not yet. But so what we did was our high school had Parkway North. That's where we went to high school. They had a Follies, which was you could do whatever you want. And people were, you know, singing and dancing and doing bands were playing and doing ballet. And we thought, we took it as like, okay, this is our chance to do what we love. And we're like, let's just do comedy. And we didn't even think about,
like, the hosts, by the way, the comedic hosts of the Follies were doing just like Monty Python sketches and stuff. They were just doing verbatim other people's material. And granted, when we did our set, we stole a bunch of material because we didn't know that you're not supposed to do that.
Right.
But we wrote some material. I remember the one bit that we wrote that I love that we wrote. I mean, it's probably not that funny, but I love that we actually went for it.
Yeah.
There was like a math club. It was so funny. There was a math club called Mu Alpha Theta Math. Stupid. And it was in our thing, and they would always announce, like, Mu Alpha Theta meeting on the commons, you know, 3 o'clock. They would announce it over the things. It's Mu Alpha Theta. If you want to join Mu Alpha Theta.
So our thing was like, no one ever wants to join from those things. They need to get better announcements. They need to hype up what they're doing more.
Like a truck and tractor pull. And so, like, those things. And we went into Mu Alpha Theta, and we. It was a thing
truck
that we did.
And protractor.
They must have crushed.
It was great. It was. It got
truck
as
truck and protractor. Oh, I love it.
It got as. That's and like again, we're 14. It was attachy. You know, when we didn't know shit, and we were just like fumbling our way through it, and you know,
but that response was amazing.
The response was great. We did really well. We felt really good, and we had a videotape. That next, like 3 weeks later, this is crazy. 3 weeks later, our friend. We started to be in youth groups, you know, which were another great opportunity for us to
meet other funny people
and perform. So like BBYO, B'nai B'rith Youth Organization, like Kansas City, Omaha, and Kansas City had a bunch of really funny people there and even St. Louis as well. And this was our chance to stand out in a new crowd.
Yeah.
And our friend from Kansas City was really funny, who was doing comedy sports at 15, which was like an improv sort of a thing. He said, I just saw this thing. Our boss told us about this thing, a young comedian special that's going to be shot for the, you know, they're going to try and shoot it for the Disney Channel at the time. This is 86.
You had to be under 16
to enter. Oh, do you guys? He said, "Have you guys?" He knew that we wanted to do stand up. He's like, "Have you guys? Do you have any videotape of you guys?"
And
doing
I guess
stand-up?
This is the time when HBO had their HBO Young Comedian.
Well, this was
special.
A couple years after Seinfeld and the other, you know, the Dangerfield one. So they're talking about a young one, and that was our dream to be on that. So we were like, "They're like, do you have any videotape?" Our friend Jeff Goldsmith, who is now out here in LA, this guy Jeff Goldsmith, and he does this unbelievable screenwriters. Podcast that like he's it's really I mean it's an amazing podcast and he's very successful but at the time he was like do you have any stand-up and we said we do we have this videotape that we just did of us in the Follies and he's like well send it off to this address make a copy of it so we had to make a copy of it we went to the guy who copied our bar mitzvah tape Scott Keller and we asked if he would make a copy of this videotape we had
we
sent it off to California. To California. It was on Beverly Boulevard.
You're 15 years old? 16?
15. 14 at the time.
Are you kidding me?
So we sent it off thinking...
Organized.
Right. Well, we're like, we're not going to hear shit. We're like, this is going off into a black hole. But I remember who it was. It was the production company. It was called Rubin & Core. It was the name of the production company. And Mark Price, who played Skippy on Family Ties, he was like involved as a producer on the show. He was going to host it because he did stand up at the time. And so we sent it off thinking we're never going to hear from them. 3 months later, or in March, we were 15 now because we turned 15 in January, still freshmen in high school. We're at home and we get a phone call from, and it's like, it's later in the night, but we didn't even realize the time difference or anything. We get a phone call from Ruben and Core. They're like, hey, listen, we saw your videotape and we got your number off the letter you sent. And we've seen hundreds of videotapes and of acts and stuff. You guys are definitely among the best of what we've seen. You can't steal other people's material. You have to write to all your own original material. And then they proceeded to give us a bunch of notes. So like, maybe you should differentiate your characters a little bit more, and you be this guy and you be that guy, or figure out some way to interact with each other, or have there be a reason why each bit you're doing involves both. I mean, complicated notes that we would not figure out for years and years and years.
Right, right.
But they said, so here's what we want you to do. Go up to your local comedy club and perform at a open mic night or all original material, shoot that and send that back our way.
Right.
So we went and we called, and they're like, no, you're too young, you can't. So we called them back and said they won't let us on stage. And they're like,
wait, this is unbelievable.
They're like, we'll handle it.
Hang on a second. So people, because this is a bit, we know the business. Just so people understand, these guys at 14 sent a tape to a production company in LA. They get called. I'm sure there were hundreds, probably thousands, right? Okay, so then the thing that I love best about this is, you do what the guy tells you to do. This is a guy who's running a production company in LA. He's got everybody who wants to work with him. And these 14-year-old kids go back and go, okay, that didn't work. What do I do next?
Yes, what do we do? What do we do?
Your cousin.
Yes, I'm so sorry. We can't do it. And they're like, relax. We'll call the club. So they call the club.
Are you serious?
So all of a sudden, the club calls us back. And they're like, you have a time next Wednesday. And we were like, oh, shit, because now
we got to do it.
We got to write material.
But this guy was so nice. They're so busy. They just move on to the next person.
Awesome.
Most of the time.
And again, that showed us that they were interested in us on some level.
Oh, now you have an oh shit moment.
Because we got to write all this material. We were writing alternative material at the time. So at the time, there were a ton of comedians in the mid 80s. You're talking 87 now.
We were doing big rap finishes.
Remember, everyone had a rap song that
Barry Sobel was really the one
who
we loved Barry Sobel and his act, because to me, he was like the Beastie Boys, and we were really into the Beastie Boys at the time. I went to see him live, and we were just fans of it, like that Beastie Boys
Jewish edgy humor that Barry Sobel was doing was really influential.
So once he did it, then everybody was like, oh, I can do a rap song finish. And it was we at the time, even we could notice that this is not working, this is not good. And so we were like,
let's do a big rap finish, let's do a twist on that. So
we, at the end of our act, we're like, we just have a really, we know it's
we're
typical
rapping.
Yeah, we're into rapping.
We know that it's typical for comedians to have a big rap finish.
So we would like to close our set tonight by
our big rap finish.
We just brought up a bunch of presents and wrapped,
just
like
slowly
wrapped birthday presents in silence.
Oh,
it was conceptual, and I don't know if they got. We had a rough time because our material was not.
Yeah. Did people respond to the?
No.
But I mean, I'm glad we went for it. Yeah. And, you know, we sent back the tape and never heard anything ever again. I don't even know if the show even got on the air, truthfully. Yeah. But it was.
What did that experience do for you in terms of informing what that you ultimately became very successful comedians looking back with hindsight?
I think it planted a tiny seed in our brains that we validated our desire to do it in the smallest way, in a way that we couldn't even articulate for many, many years. But it, in our hearts, it drove us a little bit to say, this is a worthwhile endeavor. We just came out of nowhere. We were recognized, even if the show never got made or even if we weren't a part of it, we got past hundreds and hundreds of people. So there's something interesting about what we can do, and we should.
And special, you know.
Yeah, special and different and unique. You know, the thing about us that was cool, that I think that even to this day I think is important and comes through our comedy, is we started out as such big fans of comedy. Mm. We didn't see comedy as a means to get an acting career or a sitcom or to be successful or to be famous or to be rich. We loved it so much. We just loved every aspect of it. So for us, just to do it was like a dream, to be able to go on stage and do the thing that we admired so much.
When you get that laugh, when you got that first laugh then, and you get, and tell me if it's still the same feeling, what is that feeling? What does that do to you? I don't get the sense that you guys, I never did it, got into this because you want to be famous. Let's be honest, I think we're in it and we all want that on some level, but you obviously just confirmed that. But what is that? What is that feel? I know what it was for me when it happened, but what was it for you, and what is it for you now, and has it changed when that laugh comes out of that person's head?
Mm-hmm. I will tell you, it is a something chemical and physical happens inside of your brain when that happens. It feels like a weird tingling that starts at the top of my head and goes down the back of my neck. It is like pure adrenaline. Like you feel the juice, the adrenaline shoot through you. And I will say this, you know, originally it was almost an overwhelming feeling. It was a high. It was a like an endorphin high the first time we ever experienced it. Now we end up writing more in the laugh. If we get an enormous laugh, we are inspired to create in that moment. Yeah. Something happens. Synapses fire in your brain. You go, oh, what if I said this? Like they're loving this right now. I can't go wrong.
I have to record all the time now. People said to me, how do you write? I go, I'm not even sure anymore. Like I have an idea. Then I'm walking around and then I go, oh, I could say that. Then I go on stage. Then the other thing happens. I don't just sit and write out.
No, I mean, we have ideas and bits that we bring. We're almost like a band in that, like, I'll have a nugget of something. This happened to me. You know, I was like, took my daughters to the Women's March.
Oh, you did?
Okay, my wife was in D.C. marching there. Jay was there too. Mm-hmm. I took my daughters there and I'm standing in line. We get there early. And then I have to pee. So I'm now standing in quite conceivably the worst line in the history of lines, the bathroom line at a women's march. Okay. It's like you go to a bar or a restaurant, like the men are just, you could go in and out as you please. It's like an amusement park that's shut down and you have access to everything. And the women are just out the door.
And I'm sure the city at that point, because I know they were overwhelmed with numbers, was short of poor.
Oh
John's.
My God. There were like nine for 9,000 people. And I was like, what are they doing? And I got some laughs with that joke around with the old crusted old, you know, female freedom fighter around me, and I just thought, I'm gonna do this. So as I'm in there peeing, feeling relieved, so happy, I open the door, and like there's like hundreds of people out. I open the door, my daughters are right there, and I open the door and I was like, it's okay guys, I left the seat down.
Now, did you really?
As a father, a person living in a house with three women, okay, you have to leave the seat down.
My wife has a post-it on the thing for my son: I don't want to sit in your pee. Put the seat down.
I don't want to fall in the middle of the night when I'm not thinking. I'll go to a hotel when we're on the road. I'll be alone in the hotel room. And after I pee, I put the seat down. Because if I stop, then I'm going to stop at home and I'm going to piss somebody off. I got to just keep that shit rolling. That to me was...
Did people laugh when you came out?
I got a fucking standing ovation. They were standing to begin with. But I got an ovation. I felt like they went up on their toes a little bit.
You know what? Let's get the standing ovation.
That to me was like me in life. And who knows if that'll ever make it into our act.
But people have to understand, and I do the same thing. It's only because of being seasoned and comfortable in that environment. And I think this applies to anything in life. When you're comfortable, you feel safe and you feel emotionally safe, that real you, whoever it is, whether it's your dad selling alteration products or my dad putting floors in, you're at your best. And now you reach the point in your career that you so know that space that the fact that those people are in front of you is almost meaningless because you're in this moment.
And that
feeling you described, Jason, about sort of, it's like, this is, for me, the sports metaphor is when you hit a baseball just right.
Oh,
and it doesn't feel, you don't
like anything. You don't feel like anything, because we played baseball for years as kids, and you know, sometimes you hit it and you get the bumblebees in your hand. Yeah. And you know what I mean? The bat just stings you when it's cold.
Like knife through butter.
Sweet spot of it. It just.
Golf too. I
take a moment, and when we deliver something on stage that we're really, that we like, and we get the reaction that we hope that we would get from it. And I try and take a moment and appreciate it. You know, we always say this to each other as we're about to do anything, even if we're about to go do a difficult show, wherever it may be.
Casino, corporate show,
anywhere where you feel like our hands are tied a little bit. We can't do exactly what we want to do because of whatever reason. Yeah. In comedy, it's never a good thing, you know, but
you gotta,
or they're just not there really to see you, or it's just a different vibe.
Right.
You know, and we have to do those things because we have to take care of our family and whatnot and do all those things. But, you know, every time we sit there, we're backstage, we're like, this is
really living your life on the edge, on the edge of what life is.
You like, say this to each other.
We are, that we're doing this. And I mean, you think about any, most jobs, most people's lives, like you really don't take yourself out of your comfort zone very often. You live your life in a sense not. I mean, when you have kids, you're out of your comfort zone a lot, but like in your day-to-day life, you try and minimize those moments. Comedy is the opposite. You're putting yourself out there every night to fail. Every time you walk on stage, you could fail.
And I think as comics within it, and I know you got to go, Jay, so one more minute, there it's important to continue to do that. And over time, you mentioned alt comedy. You know, there's kind of, I think it's less so now. I think it's sort of come back as a one unit. But like there was especially a time where there was club comedy and alt comedy.
Sure.
And I always felt, and I know you guys did it too, you should play both.
You should play both.
Because you grow as an artist, you grow as a performer, and you should be able to sort of be who you are in front of different people, whether it's, you know, somebody from Brooklyn with a beard who's more alt, or a guy from New Jersey who's an accountant.
And there are shortcuts you can take on the road that you just can't take with a comedy savvy audience at times. Like there are jokes and things that you'll get laughs at on the road that if you try and do it in a scene where people really know their shit, you are probably not going to get laughs with that. And
you're
gonna
be viewed as kind of hacky or hokey.
Or just like you're just like that didn't hit. I wish we would, you know, maybe we've been playing in clubs a little too long, and you know, like we've been on the road a little too much before we come back and done this show.
And the other side of it is if you go on the road and try to do that sort of more esoteric or whatever you want to call it stuff, they're sitting there going,
sometimes you're mired in a point of like, why are you doing this?
Well, so why is our stuff so complicated and why are we assuming Suma? So
yeah, we have to simplify. There are moments where we say we have to simplify, which is what it is.
Listen, I hate, we got to do another one of these because we have threads that you guys have that, you know, getting into college and all and the law stuff. We got to talk more.
We got to do that. We will.
Tell people what's going on with you guys, where you're going to be. You're shooting a special. Get all that in there.
Yes, we have a new podcast. We actually, you know, we had Scarborough Country, which you did, and Scarborough County,
really
which
fun.
Was, thank you. You were awesome. And because you know a ton about sports, it was such a fun and awesome
discussion.
Yeah,
we got to talk sports the next time.
Totally. So that's like Sports and Comedy drops every Friday on Earwolf. We were doing Scarborough County, which was not sports related. Our co-host Daniel Van Kirk, great up and coming comedian, really talented dude who comes on the road with us a bunch now. So he comes up and finds like the three craziest stories that happened in the news.
Yeah, we
this
did
week.
That. Yeah.
Oh, you did that too. Yeah. So I mean, it was like just we did that on our thing, but like that idea of batting around, you know, stuff that has nothing to do with sports, and it's a little more sort of open and
dumb people
doing dumb things. And we had been doing it as Scarborough County for a long time, but what we realized is was in the same feed. You know, we set our audience. It wasn't like getting bigger. Yeah, like we had, and with more podcasts out there in the world, you know, it just it starts to go down a little bit. And then our audience was like, you know, it's a lot of podcasts out there. They said, I don't want to listen to the sports talk. I want to just do this. And then people are like, I love the sports talk. I don't have time for both. So we cannibalized our audience. So we realized, look, we're going to have to actually extract one, rename it, rebrand it, and sort of update it and actually evolve it and put it somewhere else. So we put Scarborough County becomes Dumb People Town. It's available on iTunes. You can subscribe right now. It's at Feral Audio, which they have Harmontown and My Favorite Murder and, you know, Call Chelsea Peretti and all these great podcasts there. And they're very up and coming, a great place to do podcasts. So Dumb People Town drops every Tuesday. We've had three episodes. So by the time this goes up, it'll be like three or four episodes up. Really fun, as you say, with your podcast. I think you'll really dig it. It's a fun, riffy romp with
really
smart,
funny
people. Yeah, it
really is. I had a great time doing it.
So like that's up, and just like you said, rate it, review it, subscribe. That all helps as we sort of build our way there.
Yeah.
And then we're shooting a special for CISO, our next hour special, which we're very excited to do it there.
Yeah.
All comedy plays.
Yeah, they're great.
Really good. I mean, Stanhope special.
Where are you doing it?
Shooting it in Chicago at Lincoln Hall.
Tickets available?
Tickets available on the site or through our website, supersklars.com. You can also see all of our sites and all of our dates and whatnot, and podcasts you can listen to there, supersklars.com. But, you know, we'd love to have people who are listening to this come out and see us if you're in the Chicago area, February 11th, two shows.
Yeah, if you haven't seen them, brilliant. And
thanks,
just all of their stuff, and you're doing stuff. I know you're filling for Jim Rome, and you're just like top of your game, and I really want to do another one of these. I know you got to get out of here, but
let's do it. Next time we're in New York, or next time you're out here, we'll do part two.
Yes. everybody, thanks for listening. Go check out, go to my iTunes page and review the podcast, and check out my tour dates, paulmercurio.com. You guys are the best. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Love you guys. Seeing you every time.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, man.
A Westwood One podcast production.